I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. BP has agreed to put $20 billion into an independent escrow fund, 20 times more the money than BP has already spent responding to its gusher in the Gulf, to help reimburse people who've lost work or business due to that disaster. The fund is to be administered by Kenneth Feinberg, who oversaw the 9/11 fund. He dealt with executive pay under TARP. He oversaw the fund that compensated families who lost loved ones during the Virginia Tech shooting. President Obama's meeting today with BP executives and their lawyers was the president's first. It came hours after delivering his Oval Office speech on the crisis, telling the nation he would inform BP of their new financial responsibilities. Last night, President Obama sounded like he was going to knock some heads during today's meeting, but the president also took some knocks from the left and the right. Liberal host MSNBC host Keith Olbermann panned the Oval Office speech, saying the president offered far too little detail. Republican Minority Leader John Boehner also slammed the president for what Boehner said was exploiting the crisis to push an energy agenda. We're going to hear from an oysterman in the Gulf, but first someone who says he's in the middle politically and is in the middle of the crisis. Charlie Molossin represents Louisiana's largely coastal 3rd District. He made a huge impact on many Americans when he spoke during a congressional hearing a few weeks ago.
Our culture is threatened, our coastal economy is threatened, and everything that I know and love is at risk. Even though this marsh lies along coastal Louisiana, these are America's wetlands.
A very powerful moment from May. And Congressman Molossin joins us. Welcome. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And what did you think of the president's speech?
Well, some of what he said and my dealings with the president have been good. I think he's sincere and means well. The frustration for the people in Louisiana, frustration for me, is that unlike Katrina and other storms that we've dealt with, when you've got a hole in the bottom of the ocean floor at 5,000 feet, it's a whole different scenario, and you've got a company that obviously was not a good player, if you would, that now doesn't know how to shut this thing down and causing what will probably turn out to be the worst ecological disaster in the history of this world at the rate that it's going. Mm-hmm. And so while he said some things that I was happy to hear, he didn't get into some of the things that I wish there was some way he could, give us some assurances. Keeping the pressure on BP is definitely a priority, but when you've got something that looks like more like Keystone Cops, you're not sure that you're really getting where you need to go.
Well, and what are some of those things that you wanted to hear?
Shutting down or doing the moratorium is problematic for us in South Louisiana because of the economy.
Well, Congressman, I just want to jump in and ask you about that. We spoke with several of the people who service these rigs, and we understand how many hundreds of thousands of jobs there are just in servicing the rigs. And if the rigs are put on a moratorium, these exploratory rigs, they'll move to other countries and they won't take the jobs with them. But can you understand how the president might feel, having just heard in Congress the other heads of the top oil companies saying pretty much, one in fact, the head of Exxon, saying, you know what, we probably couldn't have done better than BP, and Congressman Waxman pointing out that they all had pretty much the same playbook for response, which we know was just completely inept.
Yeah, so in a previous administration, obviously, and of course maybe into this one too, but it's quite frustrating to think that leases were let without any plan of what to do if the worst-case scenario occurred. Much less a minor scenario. Minor scenario, I think, is what they responded to, and that was if we have a spill, it won't be a problem. We're 50 miles out. Mm-hmm. That's not a plan.
So I guess the concern is if it happens, God forbid, again.
I totally understand where the president's coming from. He's not the president of Louisiana or Mississippi or just a couple of states. He's the president of the entire United States. And if in the event this oil does get into loop currents, it's not just 4 states in the Gulf of Mexico. It could be countries. It could be the entire East Coast if it gets into the Gulf Stream. So I understand where he's coming from, but at the same time, trying to find a way to get between drill, baby, drill, and completely shutting it down. After having supported the stimulus and the other things that this president and our country inherited from the last administration in the form of majority, I have a problem with us being the ones that get our economy shut down. Some people say you can't have your cake and eat it too. I believe that there's a place for a balance, and we just can't seem to strike the balance at this point in time.
Do you think BP should be responsible for paying
totally.
The revenues lost because of the moratorium?
Totally. BP has full responsibility. I did agree with that part of what the president said, is put a third party in there to make sure that all the claims that are filed, first of all, make sure they're legitimate, but without dragging them around. And without making them go through what ExxonMobil made the Alaskans go through, fighting in the courts for years to come, this needs to be resolved. People need to be made whole. They need to be able to know what their future holds. And that's one of the things that's quite frustrating to me, is that I'm starting to sense that the word future is a word in the vocabulary of South Louisianians that's starting to drop out because they don't know that there will be a future.
Well, given this, a couple quick questions. The president has appointed Michael Bromwich, a former prosecutor, head of the MMS. He's not been in the oil industry, but he seems like a tough prosecutor. What do you think about that appointment?
Well, and not knowing him, having a mentality of being a prosecutor, then I'm thinking that he will ask the kind of questions need to be asked or should have been asked as to how the process worked and why it failed. Having somebody that doesn't understand oil and gas industry might be good, because then they don't just roll over. I understand that the previous majority reformed some of the MMS rules and regulations that impacted how they let those leases out, and that may be some of where the exact problem lies, in that they allowed for some waivers of law. For instance, the environmental impact statement, as I understand it, couldn't be completed in 30 days. Well, there's no way on God's green earth any environmental impact statement on any project will be done in 30 days, so there's summarily just a waiver. So they waived the law and allowed for this to happen, and that's criminal in my mind.
Well, Ian, you've been working on a couple of other issues, bringing a mobile health unit to your area, and you've introduced the Spill Act. This is to address the legal liability issues. You met with some widows who want the law overseeing the amount of damages that survivors can get to be changed.
Right.
What else would you like to see?
I'm looking at a piece of legislation that says when that oil gets to within, say, the boundaries of 3-mile limit for Louisiana or 9 miles for most other states, at some point the states have the opportunity to take things into their hand and start putting out equipment, and will be reimbursed for whatever it is they decide they want to do. For instance, the berm project that was discussed, and then the bureaucrats and the scientists, well, we don't know if that's going to help. 6 years from now, it might be problematic. I can't worry about 6 years from now. I have to worry about maybe 6 days or 6 weeks. To do nothing is not an option. If I'm making a mistake, then I'm trying, and that's better than doing and then sitting on my hands or being told I can't do anything.
Because I feel I have to throw out that the concern was that the oil's just going to go over the darn berms, and it's been going over the booms. Your thoughts on Congressman Markey's call for BP and other oil companies to invest in new technology? Is this unbelievable to you?
It is. It's entirely difficult to fathom, especially since you look at the way the oil and gas industry operates. They're operating with 21st century technology and trying to clean up with 20th century technology. And of course, some people have made fun about Kevin Costner's equipment. But Mr. Costner went to the oil industry in 1993 with this equipment, and they thought it was great stuff, but they weren't interested in buying it because they're interested in drilling and making money and not putting safety for cleanup. That's not a priority to them. And then he came to the federal agencies, who basically did the same thing. Says, oh, that's nice, that's neat, but, we're not interested in that kind of stuff. I don't know all the answers, but another one of the piece of legislation I'm working on right now is to provide for all these suggestions and ideas of processes and equipment, et cetera, that have been sent to BP. I'd like for the government to gather all those and then make some recommendations to the Congress of what we can do to require that that the companies who are drilling have a plan, at least a plan A, and if possible, an alternate B and an alternate C in the event this should happen again.
Well, Congressman Mollison, again, we're talking to Charlie Mollison, who represents Louisiana's largely coastal 3rd District. What about, you know, maybe you could maybe call it the Faustian pact that politicians like yourself made with the oil industry, backed by all Americans who use oil. But you worked for a bill that opened up an area of 8 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico to offshore oil drilling. This was in 2006. And now this increased the amount of federal royalties that went to the states. That, you know, something that was probably very tantalizing. But do you have second thoughts about that now?
No, I don't. You know, I still believe that we can do it. We can drill, and we can drill safely. The bureaucratic process needs to be reformed. Obviously, there's something that went wrong there. But we appear to have a player that was interested in making more money. I'm concerned that the greed got him, just as we saw in the financial situation when we took the regulators away, or the regulators weren't responsible for watching the banks any longer. You know, so the same people that are hollering and screaming they don't want government involved in their lives are the first ones that are screaming, where's the government when this well blew? This disaster, I think, finally blows the picture up for people to understand. If we're going to be allowing this, the states themselves should be getting some monies to protect that which is not only valuable to Louisiana, but that which is valuable to this whole country, the America's wetlands that I live and hunt and fish in. It's my home. It's my heartland. It's, you know, means a whole lot to me and to the people that are down there, even more so than me, because they make their livelihoods from it.
What's it like to see it now? I mean, we have seen the pictures.
It's heartbreaking. You know, it's difficult to go out there and not just have your heart sink, to talk to the people who live and work, for instance, on Grand Isle and St. Bernard and Plaquemines Parish, and they live in the water. I mean, it's their life. It's everything to them. It's just heart-wrenching, and you can hear the anger. As I mentioned, the word future seems to be disappearing out of their vocabulary because they don't know if there's a future for them. We've been through Katrina, followed by Rita, and then this past 2 years ago, we had back-to-back Gustav and Ike. These people have been through quite a bit, particularly the fishermen, and now to have their livelihoods in jeopardy, and not just for one season, for potentially a decade or decades, we don't know, and it's quite traumatizing, I can assure you.
Congressman Charlie Mollison, representing Louisiana's coastal 3rd District, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was good being with you, Robin.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. In late April, as oil from the BP well was moving towards the Gulf shores, we spoke with John Tezvich, owner of Port Sulphur Fisheries Company. They lease about 4,000 acres of oyster grounds in Louisiana. Well, we called him again today. John, BP has agreed to put monies into an independent fund, as the president outlined last night. So what did you think when you heard the president's speech about this independent escrow fund, but also him saying it had to address the needs of people like yourself who've been harmed?
I really am appreciative of that. I think that is key because many of the businesses that have been affected by this bill don't trust BP to be there, you know, in the months ahead. They may be here now, but will they be here for 6 months? So having that escrow account is key.
Well, in fact, you told us you felt this was your idea.
Well, I had even emailed the White House last week, and I spoke about it to the Labor Secretary when we met with Ms. Solis here last week. And so anyway, it trickled through. If that's for businesses and displaced workers, I think that's a great start.
What is happening to your business? Understand about half the oyster beds are closed?
Yes, we probably have about half of the beds are closed. The other areas that remain open, a lot of the vessels that would normally harvest at this time of year aren't harvesting because they're working in fighting off the spill. That is hampering our ability to get enough seafood in to keep our processors open and keep our customers going. So on the big scale, this is, you know, something that is potentially crippling for our entire seafood industry. And it's not just a problem for us. It's really a national problem because the Gulf Coast supplies so much seafood to the entire country. And, you know, we don't know how long it will be, you know, that we can get the resource back to where it was. Nobody knows that yet.
Well, you know, you've told us in the short term you may have to shut down and lay off, what, about 60 employees because of this inability to get the oysters in. But talk long term with us. Does oil kill the oyster beds? We know that the president is appointing Ray Mabus, former governor of Mississippi, to talk about a restoration plan. Can you restore oyster beds?
Well, oyster beds can be restored. You can bring in new material. What we cannot understand yet is the long-term impact of the oil and the dispersants. If it affects the food chain and it affects the larval growth of oysters or in other seafood, those are complex issues that if something is not right, that you know, you could have long-term detriment to that natural resource. You know, you can do physical reclamation and put down material and enhance beds, but if your water is not clean and you know and correct, your seafood you know may not come back like it was.
Well, given all of this, are you considering a different future?
Well, I've made a comment. I says, you know, I think BP owes me a golden parachute. You know, I'm an executive in my company. I want a golden parachute. I want to be able to give me my ticket out of here.
If you have to go.
And because I now have a damaged business, I don't know what the future holds, but it will be challenging. I know it will be challenging. And I think BP should be willing to buy my damaged company and assets so I can do something else. I'm saddled with, you know, this investment that will not, you know, be as profitable as it was before. What am I to do with it?
How old are you?
I'm 53 years old.
You start something new?
I wasn't planning on starting anything new. You know, I was hoping to grow my business. Our business was actually in plans of expanding on several different fronts. We were looking at doubling our capacity in a few years. We're building a new processing facility. All of that is now on hold. I had a $1.5 million grant from the government to help build this plant where we're investing $3 million of our own. All that's on hold. And there's no accounting for that. You know, how do we account for that? What this company would have been. That's hard, you know. And then now we're looking at facing a shutdown, at least temporarily. It will be at least 4 months before we could maybe have enough oysters to begin our operations again. And then you have to build your whole customer base all over again. It's a daunting task that, you know, I don't know. It's we've never faced anything this tough. We've been through Katrina, and I fought back after Katrina, but it was nails and lumber and manpower that put my house back and put my boats back in the water and rebuilt our docks. Our resource was not challenged like this. And when your resource is challenged, it's worse than the infrastructure. Infrastructure, we know how to rebuild the resource. We may never rebuild it like it was, and that's scary.
Well, John Tesvich, an oyster farmer in Port Sulphur, Louisiana. His company is Port Sulphur Fisheries. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Robin. Also, my processing company, the Maripure Oyster Company, that we sell oysters all over the country through the processing company.
Well, let's get some orders in.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
John, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Again, today's news, BP has agreed to contribute up to $20 billion into an independent escrow fund to help pay for lost wages and business in the Gulf. Kenneth Feinberg will oversee how the money is dispersed. He oversaw the 9/11 fund and the fund for families of the Virginia Tech shooting victims. He also dealt with executive pay under TARP. Today's White House meeting included Admiral Thad Allen, National Incident Commander, the White House point man on the disaster, Carol Browner of the Office of Energy and Climate, Lawrence Summers of the National Economic Council, and White House Counsel Bob Baer. In addition to Tony Hayward, BP's team includes its board chair, BP's America's CEO, Lamar McKay, and Jamie Gorelick, a former deputy attorney general in the Clinton White House. She's now heading BP's legal team. Meanwhile, BP has begun to burn the oil that it's siphoning from the Gulf. And as you may know, yesterday there was a new estimate of the Gushers' flow. Not 5,000 barrels a day, as BP claimed initially, but upwards of 60,000 barrels a day. Energy Secretary and Nobel scientist Stephen Chu was personally involved in that new calculation. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us if you want to send an email or make a phone call. You can also scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. We're going to take a break for the very latest news and be back with much more Here and Now. President Obama says the oil disaster in the Gulf is a challenge to Americans to reduce their reliance on oil and cut carbon emissions. Well, some students from West Philadelphia are way ahead of him. They're the only high school team to make it into the $10 million Progressive Insurance Automotive XPRIZE. The contest challenges teams to build a car that can travel 100 miles on a single gallon of gas. The average car today gets just 19 miles per gallon on average. Simon Hager is the West Philly Hybrid X Team director, and Jacques Wells is the team's co-captain. Let's start with Jacques. Your team actually has two cars in the contest, a mainstream and an alternative race car. So tell us about the mainstream car first.
For our mainstream vehicle, we are pretty much stripped down a Ford Focus and rebuilt it to the likings of the West Philly Hybrid X team. Mm-hmm. We put a two-cylinder Harley-Davidson motor in it along with an electric motor to make it a high school-made hybrid.
That's right. Well, and so you've got this electric motor. You use lithium-ion batteries in that?
Yes.
And then the gallon of gas, because this is that's the restriction. It has to be a gallon of gas that would go in the motorcycle engine?
Yes.
Yeah. What about the alternative class car?
We have a kit car made by Factory 5 called the GTM, which we have the same electric motor that's used in our mainstream vehicle, but we have a biodiesel engine.
That was from a Volkswagen?
Yes.
Well, Simon Hoger, you've led these teams to victory in the Tour del Sol. That's a solar-powered car contest. But this XPRIZE contest, you have to have, you know, these have to be cars that can be manufactured. Can these cars be manufactured?
Well, we believe so. One of the wonderful things about the Progressive Automotive XPRIZE is that it's required a full-fledged business plan that shows that you could produce them at 10,000 units a year. And that there's a market for them. That restriction really created a different series of challenges for us. We were looking for a car that is safe and affordable. We use off-the-shelf technology, and I think we've shown that you can use technology that's available now in an innovative way to get over 100 miles per gallon.
Well, and Jacques, take us through some of the things you learned while doing this. For instance, while you put a two-cylinder Harley-Davidson motorcycle in a Ford Focus.
Watch out for sharp edges. Ford doesn't make a vehicle that comes standard to fit a Harley-Davidson motor in it, so you learn how to do a lot of custom fabrications, making things work. I mean, because 9 times out of 10, when you get a new part that's supposed to go in, it won't fit for you, so you have to make it fit and still be safe. So,
well, and this is, you know, a renowned program, especially since we know that half of students from inner cities like West Philly can drop out. As many as 15% of those who graduate may have learned only at a 12th grade level. So this program seems to be working. Why? I mean, what can schools learn from it?
I think there's a lot that can be learned from it. And it's not that we're doing, you know, I want to be careful. I don't want to take credit for inventing something. It's good education. Progressive education has been around forever. And it's common sense. You put students at the center of their education. You ask them questions. You value their input. And you give them real work to do. Have them solve real problems. It's a much better learning experience than sitting in a desk and regurgitating information. And the sad thing is that, especially in the urban environment, is not working. The basic purpose of school is to teach children how to read, write, and do math. And they're not even doing that. And then the next level is to help them to develop critical thinking skills, 21st century skills. For the most part, urban education can't even get the basics across. And there's a lot of innovative programs around the country, and we're just one example of what happens when you give kids real work to do. The learning comes alive. And so, yeah, we're much more passionate about good learning and good education than building hybrid cars.
Jacques, have you taken the cars, either of them, for a spin?
Hogger won't let me drive. But, you know, every time it does start, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air for everyone because, you know we actually did something right.
Well, you did more than something right. You've made it through several
phases of this contest. So we wish you luck as you go forward.
Thank you.
That's Jacques Wells. He's co-captain of the West Philly Hybrid X team. Simon Hauger, the team's director, competing in the Progressive Insurance Automotive X Prize to build a 100-mile-per-gallon car. Best of luck to you both.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And if Jack Reese didn't get behind the wheel of the car, others did. To see a video, you can go to hereandnow.org. Before we go today, Kid Rock superstar Justin Roberts, he'll be here. And when we come back in about 30 seconds, Porrig O'Malley, a peace professor trying to work his magic in the Balkans. In 30 seconds, Here and Now. Some people call Porrig O'Malley the peace professor. He's devoted his life to working with divided peoples, Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, Shiite and Sunni in Iraq. He's professor of international peace and reconciliation at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and just back from a conference in Kosovo in the divided city of Mitrovica, which is split between Serbians in the north, Kosovar Albanians in the south, bitter foes in the war that ended in 1999. But they came together for the recent conference with people from South Africa and other countries. It was part of something called the Forum for Cities in Transition, and Porrig joins us to talk about it. But Porrig, I want to start with news from Britain yesterday, the Bloody Sunday report, which was released by the British government and concluded, after 12 years, that British soldiers were not justified when they killed 14 civilians in Londonderry in 1972. Took a long time for that report. They say the civilians pose no threat. And this is something the families of the victims claimed all along. Now, the soldiers aren't going to be prosecuted, something you say is impossible. But it reminds us, just in coming to this conclusion, that this is something you try to do with divided peoples, not ignore that one side may have more of the truth than the other side.
In order to move forward from any conflict, you have to deal with the legacy of the past. That means establishing a common narrative of events and how people were killed that is acceptable to all communities.
So how do you do that in Mitrovica? You have an Albanian guerrilla movement, the Kosovo Liberation Army, people who felt that they were oppressed and were launching attacks on Serbs. But then you have this violent reaction from, you know, the Yugoslav military and massacres. So how do you navigate that? Who gets to claim?
Well, part of what we had in mind was that you would bring divided cities together, all of which had experienced deep and traumatic conflict, and you would have them share their experiences and share the ways in which they slowly came to the conclusion that violence was not working. So in the nine cities that were in Mitrovica, some, like Derry, Londonderry, were more advanced in the path of reconciliation. Some, like Mitrovica itself, was at the lower end of the stick. But that did not mean that the Mitrovicans, both Serbs and Albanians, could not learn from the Irish experience. So, for example, Derry stepped forward and said that it would be the host of the 2011 conference. But the most important thing it did was that the newly established police service in Northern Ireland came to Mitrovica and they met with members of the Kosovo police who were Albanian and only follow Albanian laws, and who are Serbs and only follow Serbs' laws.
Two separate police forces.
And a team, Serb police officers and Albanian police officers, agreed to go to Northern Ireland for training. And that is a real tangible result.
And let's remind people, Mitrovica, there's a bridge across the Ibar River there that separates the Serbs and the Albanians. As you start this conference, what are you hearing from the Serbs and the ethnic Albanians? Do you hear conversations like, yeah, but you did this? Yeah, well, but then you did this. I mean, is it that simplistic?
No. In all of these cities, what you find is that fear is the common denominator of all division. One community is afraid to cross the street or a bridge and enter in to another community. Whereas to you and me, why not?
Yeah.
For example, all our volunteers walked freely back and forth over the bridge. Half of our attendees from the conference stayed in hotels in Mitrovica North and mingled with the community and went to their schools north and south, and talked to youngsters so that youngsters could hear that, wow, ours is not the only little conflict in the world. There are at least 9 others out there where people are experiencing the same kind of divisions and looking for ways to deal with them.
So you mentioned that one of the ways, at least the outcome from the conference, was that police from both sides of the bridge, Albanian and Serbs, would go to Londonderry and have some training. You always talk about increments. Is that the increment you were looking for? Like, for instance, some of these police may come back and start crossing the bridge?
Since this is a forum for all of the cities, not just for a particular city, what I was looking for was a number of results that would strengthen the cohesiveness of the forum itself, so that the cities who were involved in it believed that there were real and tangible outcomes possible from which they could all gain. That happened in Mitrovica. Probably the biggest impact was the psychological impact. For the first time, Serbs and Albanians from across that river had come together, organized an international conference, and had carried it out successfully. Their belief in themselves was greatly increased. Looking forward, there are 2 important things have to happen. Number one, all the promises made to Mitrovica by other cities have to be carried out, so that when the cities reconvene in Derry in 2011, we can actually tick off all the outcomes that were promised and all the outcomes that were met. The second thing is we want to draw the new cities, like Jerusalem, like Beirut, to draw those cities more into the process, so that the attendees are more representative of people and administrators who work in the municipalities themselves and have to deliver services to the people. Because in all of these cities, you will find that 2 of the major problems are electricity and water, the absence of them.
Something they all have in common.
But one of the cities there was Haifa. Haifa is a city of Jews and Arab Israelis, which is often held up as a model for how Arab Israelis and Jews can live in harmony. But Haifa offered to take a delegation of Serbs and Albanians to Haifa to instruct them in how to repair the water pipes that needed to be repaired in Mitrovica, so that next year Mitrovica can in fact have clean water. What they lack when they're at the bottom of both the developmental scale and at the top of the conflict scale is capacity to do anything.
That's Padraig O'Malley, Professor of International Peace and Reconciliation at UMass Boston. Padraig, thanks as always.
Not at all. Always a pleasure.
And I just want to take a second to remind you that you can always listen to our program live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast or listen later through our archives, hereandnow.org. You can find us on XM Sirius Radio. Follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Before we go, Justin Roberts at the top of the Kindy Charts, Kindergarten Audiences, Independent Artists, in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. You know what we need? A really hard-rocking song about trick-or-treating.
Come on, Mom, the clock says 4, and I'm ready to hit every door.
Trick or Treat by Justin Roberts. He's part of a big wave of kindy music, independent rock for kids. He's sold more than 100,000 CDs, been number 1 on iTunes and Amazon.com's kids list. The New York Times calls him the Judy Blume of kiddy rock because, in addition to writing about trick or treating or bunk beds, he also sings about divorce and cancer. Justin Roberts' new album, Jungle Jim, is out this month, and he joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Justin, this is a personal favorite genre for me. I particularly enjoy trout fishing in America, as my hair had a party last night.
But I just heard that live a couple weeks ago.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just curious, how did you get into this? Was it groups like Trout Fishing, who are a little bit older than you, or how did you get into it?
Back in the early 90s, I was working at a preschool while I was at night playing in a band in Minneapolis. The band was called Pimentos for Gus. And I just started writing songs for the kids at the school, and one thing led to another, and I eventually had a whole bunch of songs and recorded them and put out the first CD, which was Great Big Sun.
And when you got that first sense that you were onto something, what was that like?
I think the biggest surprise for me, I had a song called Giraffe Nightingale that I played with the Pimentos for Gus band, and it's a song that has four verses and no chorus and no repeating words, but it's a song about a giraffe and a nightingale, and I thought they might like it. But it was written for adults, and I played it for the kids, you know, and they listened to it. And the next day they said, oh, let's hear that giraffe song again, and I played it again. And eventually they were singing along, and, you know, after a couple months they performed it for their parents without me singing it.
Then the giraffe said to the nightingale bird, he said, I'm gonna stretch my neck so long like some never heard of, and you can sing until it hurts my ears because you're melody is so sweet, takes away all my fears.
I was like, well, I guess kids don't need, you know, something to be really simple. They'll catch on to anything. And so that was kind of, that opened my mind to writing wilder and wilder songs as I went along.
Well, and exploring some of the most anxious and perhaps existential moments of childhood. I'm referring to, for instance, one of the songs from the new CD. It's about getting lost at the mall and listening as the PA calls out for someone to come get you. Let's listen.
Then I hear your name on the intercom. It's calling out for you because I love you, Mom, and I'm never getting lost. My teeth I'm gonna floss. I'm just never getting lost again.
You know, I got to tell you, Justin, I had a little tear during this one, the part where he says, I hear your name on the intercom. It's calling out for you because I love you, Mom. I'm never going to get lost. My teeth I'm going to floss.
A little joke to try to ease the,
well, but
the sadness.
But it's not. I mean, kids make all sorts of pledges.
Promises. Yeah, exactly. That was the idea. I'd been thinking about writing a song about this subject because it's such a common human experience. And I finally came up with that rhyme of intercom and mom, and that it just opened the whole song for me. And it was one of those ones where I'd written it and I knew it was really sad and I played it for people. And most people, you know, the band members and my wife and various folks cried when they heard it. And then I was like, oh, I got to put it on the record, I guess. Let's
have a
real tearjerker.
No, but do you worry ever about upsetting kids? I mean, you know, lost kids. I can't imagine what it's like for kids to see newscasts and all that stuff. And do you ever worry about upsetting them?
Well, you know, I find that having something that they can relate to is something really powerful. There's a song off the Pop Fly CD that's called Giant Size Butterflies. That's a song about a first day of school, and the kid in the song is, you know, really anxious about going to school for the first time.
I felt so nervous in the morning light. My mom said it would be all right. Still, I had giant-sized butterflies on that first day.
And I found a lot of parents could come back to me and say, we use that song to get our son or daughter over the fear of going to school, and it was really helpful, and it reminded me of my own anxieties that I have of trying new things for the first time. And, you know, that's been the most powerful responses to the music, is hearing things like that.
But then there's your song about divorce. Let's just play a little bit of Mama Is Sad. It's from the Yellow Bus CD.
Mama is sad and I know that. She's taken off her ring. Mama is sad and I know that. I give her everything.
Now, what do parents and kids say to you about this song? You know, a kid trying to cheer up his mom with toys, you know. What do they say to you about that?
I think people have used it in various ways that, you know, sometimes they don't use it in reference to divorce. It could just be something sad that happens in the family, and it's a way for the parents and kids to talk about what it means to be sad and how it's okay to be sad. And then I've had, you know, some really personal responses where a family has been going through a divorce and played the song. You know, I've found it interesting that people have responded so positively to it, because for me, I kind of thought, well, maybe it is a little too sad for kids. I don't know.
Well, and where does it come from for you? Because I understand you and your wife don't have children, which is always a personal decision with people. But that was surprising, because you're so immersed in kids through the music.
I think I have a pretty vivid memory of my own childhood. I can see certain images really clearly. Like in the trick-or-treating song, I can still see myself laying out all the candy and organizing it in every possible combination like the kid does in the song.
Well, and they're not all, you know, angst-driven.
Sure.
They're just plain fun. I know you have a guitar there.
Yep.
How about a cardboard box? And is this, by the way, a childhood memory, getting the cardboard box in the mail?
Not exactly, but it's a song about a child and a dad playing together, and I have very vivid memories of my dad and I playing together when he would come home from work, and so I think that definitely fit in there.
We got this cardboard box in the mail. Dad emptied it out last night and we sailed out into the middle of the sea. It was all right cause I felt the moonlight following me. We imagined a sky so clear and dark, splattered the stars, erased all the sharks. Everything was perfect as could be. It was all right cause I felt the moonlight following me.
Justin Roberts singing Cardboard Box from his new CD, Jungle Jim. So here you are on the top of a growing heap of bands making kindy rock. We mentioned Trout Fishing in America, mm-hmm. Secret Agent 23 Skidoo. They might be giants doing more kid rock. But I'm remembering back when Rafi decided, you know, he seemed to have had it with kids for a while, and he decided to slide over and try some other form of music. And quickly, he went back. But how about you?
I mean, I sometimes write songs that are more for adults, but I think the surprising thing I found is I think because I'm able to explore topics like getting lost or divorce, or I have a song about death, and then I'm able to explore really fun things like trick-or-treating or sleepovers, I feel like a lot of those things are common to us all, whether or not you're a kid or an adult. I mean, people often listen to the records and are like, I forgot about that, about my own childhood, but you said that, and then I remembered it again vividly. And, I mean, I'm singing for the adults as much as the kids, I guess, at that point.
Justin Roberts, musician and therapist. His new album is called Jungle Jim, out this month. He's been speaking to us from WBEZ in Chicago. Justin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, who knew when we came to a stop? Somewhere they'd be giving me lollipops. Covered in hair.